Hello, dear listener, and welcome back to The Three-Handed Game, the only Avengers commentary podcast which answers the questions, are snakes going to be a danger in space? I'm Brendan.
I'm Stephen.
And I'm not the Mara for this one, although there are rubbery surprises in the garden nonetheless.
Now, with all these snakes around, it can only mean one thing, that we are, rather confusingly, continuing with our theme of Reach for the Stars. And we'd like to, first of all, thank you for the wonderful feedback we've had from you listeners for our debut episode for From Venus with Love. And it's really buoyed us to get on and record another one for you this month.
It has, as there are no girls on this podcast so far. Although, we are a flexible lot, and we are here to entertain. So,
yes,
I'll pull out me culottes and me armpit-length gloves and see how that goes down with the audience.
Quite. Now,
Harvey Gould.
Stephen, would you like to tell the listeners what episode we're covering this month?
Certainly. It is Invasion of the Earthmen. So it's Series 6, Episode 15, I believe. And it was shot, I believe, in 1967, which surprised me, actually. I thought it was a lot later than that. Aired in the US in March of 68, and the UK in January of 69. And it's written by, well, one of our old favourites, perhaps, Terry Nation.
See if you can spot the Terry Nation Street bits. It does get a bit soapy. So, I mean, he didn't invent the term meme, but my God, he gave it a good plug, didn't he?
Yes, it is. It is Invasion of the Earthmen. It is by Dear Terry, who would go on to be the script editor for this season of The Avengers.
That's right. And he jumped deliberately and forcefully into the lap of Roger Moore and Tony Curtis for The Persuaders.
That's right.
So this was his jumping off point.
And I think I'm right in saying that this is the first episode recorded with Linda. Like, it wasn't meant to be the first one to go out. They were going to do an introductory, but this was, I believe, the first one she recorded.
But it was also a combination, wasn't it? Or there were a lot of other things going on behind the scenes,
as we will discover.
Which we shall put our armpit-length glove on at some point.
Yes. Right. So, without any further ado, and for reasons that will become clear, dear listener, your code word to press start on your copy is the word wig.
I feel seen, but anyway.
And just a reminder how we cue these up. Whatever version you are watching, you want to get past the Studio Canal or A&E logo. And you want to be basically in sort of a black screen just before the opening credits start. Now, Richard has his finger on the button, and I am going to say, wig. And we're off.
We're off to the land of Kolor.
Yes, indeed.
Am I the only one here who really misses the cute amber opening titles that were...
Yes, I love those. For those of you with the DVD, Blu-ray, modern editions, etc., you can only find those on the episode Split, I think. It's either Split and, or Getaway.
And on the end of Forget Me
Yes,
Not.
Yes, that's right. Yes. I think they may have gotten rid of it once Linda's own hair grew back. But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
And this is lovely, and I can see why she was cast.
Yes, yes.
No one else can frolic through a field into a useless door threshold and look quite as good as she just did. It reminds me of Blazing Saddles, you know, when they're when the villains are trying to raid the town and of course they just put up a little toll gate and they all have to wait there and find their 20-cent pieces, their dimes, I should say. Okay, so we have lovely Chook Wire.
Yes. Now, don't take offence.
Ah, I saw what you did there.
Now, here we have George Rubicek, who will be familiar to Doctor Who viewers as the nominatively determined Captain Hopper in Tomb of the Cybermen.
Mm. Doing the accent.
Yes.
We might see him later on in another episode that we do.
We might indeed.
So a few of these boys went on to really very good careers. Mm. But not all.
Yes.
We also have the first sighting of, did you spot the flashing lady, so to speak, that lady flasher?
Yes, indeed.
Did you spot her, Stephen? And there, of course, is Janet Fielding's stand-in. But did the lady flasher, when she comes up again, I will mention in case you lads don't. Because we're just hiding behind a bit of polystyrene. Oh, buggery bollocks. Mm. There she is. And that, dear listener, in the lovely Cage episode of Star Trek Uniform, is Lucy Fleming. And yes, that Fleming.
Oh, right.
So she's Peter's daughter, and Ian was her uncle. And you can actually see a family resemblance. She looks much like her dad. They were going for a Village of the Damned look here deliberately, and you'll notice we haven't mentioned the third member of the cast or the fourth, but there you go. Knowing evil little grins, which means they went to an English public school. But Lucy had a fantastic career, and she actually does it really well. You know, Peter Fleming was considered the only good writer in the family by both the press and the critics. Apart from Kingsley Amis. No, it's really true. And she has a really interesting life. She was married to Simon Williams.
Oh.
Yeah, she was. In fact, even at the time. We should mention why he was called Chunky, but it's not in her diary. So he was, of course, group captain in Gilmore Inn. Remembrance of the Daleks with Sylvester McCoy. And here we have Harvey Gould designing Tara King as, did you know who she was modelled on? So they talked about Jean Harlow, but by the time Clemens came in, because apparently Jean Harlow was a look that was in fact a big comeback at the time, Shirley MacLaine.
Oh.
And if you think about it.
I see it now.
A young Shirley MacLaine. And actually the critics at the time said she was a flat rear-wheeled bicycle version of Irma LaDuce, which wasn't kind. No. And I think they meant that she was a little heavy at the front.
Well, this is the outrageous thing. They hired her and then said, now go lose some weight. And she was by no means overweight. They just wanted her to be thin and blonde, to which she said, well, why don't you hire a thin blonde girl? But of course, they put her on speed.
There was quite a bit of that going on, though, wasn't there? I mean, they... Yeah. Diapertaff, I think, was the brand they used. But she... I mean, there's a very interesting history as to how Linda landed this one. And of course, this is one of the first recordings, so you can see why they're sort of working out who she is and what her look is.
Yes. And she's referred to as Miss King throughout, rather than Tara. But we probably should explain the whole thing about, the disguise. So this episode was one of the first recorded by new incoming producer John Bryce, who had also produced half of season two and all of season three. But those episodes were rejected, and Brian Clemens came back in and had to salvage the three episodes that were completed. And Invasion of the Earthmen is largely the least affected of three, but because Linda is not blonde throughout the rest of the season, they had to insert scenes of her saying, I'm trying a disguise! I'm wearing a wig! Whereas in this scene, it is her own hair, which is shortly about to fall out. Which is why even when it goes back to being brown for most of the season, for about half the season, she wears a wig.
But she does mention, Stephen, do you remember any of this? She does talk eloquently in the early interviews of how she was being thrown, meant to toss off, obviously, but she was thrown so many different ways of working. And it was Johnny Bryce who was saying, no, we want a voluptuous feminine lassie. And that came from the US as well, of course. And they also wanted, she was getting divergent things on be innocent, be guileless, but also then be confident and sassy, and then be super intelligent. You're meant to be the brightest in your year, but also be, disingenuous and disingenuously ingenuous. I mean, what a great line. And but then, of course, because it's the 60s, so the publicists actually said to the Daily Mail at the time that to announce her that we've discovered the new Shirley MacLaine, but at 5 feet 9 inches tall and 38 inches elsewhere. And Brian Clemens then went on in that interview to describe her as sexier, more pneumatic in build, and with a bosom and hips.
Pneumatic.
To rival any in the land. It sounds like they're describing the new SRN hovercraft, doesn't it? She's capable of crossing the channel under her own steam.
I just don't think they know what they're doing just yet, right? And yeah. Obviously there's issues with John Bryce as the producer. But even just things like I really don't like the car. It's an AC428 convertible. Where is the Bentley? Where is the Rolls? It just doesn't look right. A brand new one.
It was not even available in the States because it was too powerful. So I think it was a V8 that was souped to perform as a V12. There were very few built. It is quite beautiful and understated. But even Pat said, look, it's nice to have a gear shift that works, but just keep your foot away from the accelerator. Is this the car that Linda famously not drove?
Yes, that's right.
Yes, go on.
I don't know if it's a production of this episode or one of the other two that then get reworked, but in one of them, Tara is given the AC Cobra to drive and Linda promptly crashes it into a brick wall. And she's fine. Yeah. She wasn't travelling very fast. But after that, she even when they gave her a different car, she's like, it was mostly Sid driving. Sid Child.
It's now in Jane's Book of Motor Cars as the first to be equipped with airbags provided by the pilot. Now, it was actually intended to be Linda's car, yes. But, you know, didn't go, so that's why you see Steed driving it in this one.
Well, I do wonder if that's another Bryce-ism, because Steed only starts his vintage car obsession sort of late in the second series, early in the third series, off the top of my head. And in
that's
the,
true.
That's right, it's a Lando.
Yeah, I think he does have
Martin to its mates.
We do see one vintage car in season one in Tunnel of Fear.
That's right.
But in other early Kathy Gale episodes, he is driving a low-line convertible, such as in Propellant 23, I want to say. Now,
this room.
There's Pat sewing. I've still got it.
Now, Stephen, what do you think about this set compared to Venus's Venus's office from last month?
It's unbelievable. And again, they just don't know what they're doing just yet, do they? And it's all tinsel and, you know, looks like some kind of mobile that a primary school student might take, you know, into school for a homework project.
I would have said a Tourette-ish recent graduate from theatre school showing us that he's not ever thrown out any of his Easter egg wrappers or Christmas decorations. Oh, we've got William Squire, boys.
William Lucas.
I meant to say William Lucas. I keep calling him Squire because he was, of course, the Squire in Black Beauty when he had that fulsome beard.
Mm.
And this
I remember that from childhood, yes.
Yeah, and how he plays it is very interesting. And now we get into the League of British Fascism and what we think of British fascism. And I wanted to say...
Well, it's another Terry trope, isn't it? Very sort of Khaled / Nazi thunderbolt, lightning bolt insignia that we saw as a bit of a clue in that first first scene after the tag scene, the intro scene. But this is really just, well, going back to the well about Nazis, homegrown Nazis in the UK. And yeah, it's very, very much a trope of his.
And string pictures. Remember having to do those at school with little nails on a bit of black chipboard?
Yes. I find the sort of fascistic imagery very interesting because in terms of UK television, we are pre-Star Trek. And I have seen it written in places, oh, you know, Star Trek was clearly an influence for this, but I mean, maybe John Bryce had been to America and seen an episode, but I doubt it. Well, actually, Terry had been living in the States. He did go over there in 1967.
He did, but I would honestly conjecture to all of those younger critics, they don't remember the premiere of a certain film called Casino Royale.
Ah.
When are we doing the podcast on Casino Royale?
Yeah, I can't understand why we missed it.
I don't know why we've never done it. And that, of course, looks exactly like
no,
this.
You're right.
And plays on this, and the champions play on it. And, of course, I think both are actually nods to Doctor Strangelove.
True, true.
Because it's very Kubrick. Mm. But I honestly think, and Terry was widely read as and well-versed as a comic writer, first and foremost. Oh, there's the set again. This set is in The Champions, it's in Persuaders, it's in, it's probably just an Elstree backlot. Never before have I seen it redecorated as Cesar Romero's hairdresser's corridor. And what do you think of the chartreuse again? Linda's always going banging on about their choice of chartreuse for she and Pat, and I can really see what she means.
Well, I do have to...
Lucy!
I do...
No, it's not
I
Lucy.
Do have to wonder if these sets were formative for... Ms. Mary Tam.
Oh, that's... It's what everybody is redecorating in Tara with this week. Oh, and here we go with... I think he's taking the piss out of Kit Peddler with
yes.
this thing.
Yes. Oh, good.
We should also mention who this is on screen right now with the dodgy wrist and fifth metatarsal.
Oh, well, I don't know who he is. I know who
Do
the
you
other
know
chap
this is,
is.
Stephen?
No, yeah. Going to have to tell us, Richard.
Marvellous young Christopher, I'll get back to you. He's in the very last episode of UFO, The Long Sleep. He plays a very dodgy bastard in, I think he's in Callan. He's certainly in The Persuaders. He's in a whole lot of other wonderful, wonderful things. And Christian Roberts is his name. Thank you, Christian Roberts. And he plays, generally plays this kind of, well, you'd call him a psycho now, wouldn't you? But he plays this type of cranky young lad. He's even in Space 1999 doing something very similar. Or am I thinking of another blonde young man? I possibly am.
There were a few.
Sorry about that. It's all been a while. But yes, we're doing this on the run. He's really, really good. Career kind of... went pretty much all through the 70s. I'll look up if you're interested in him. But I actually find him in everything he does the most menacing little thing in the room. And that includes Janet Fielding's stand-in in the backyard. He's just got that great edge of... He's kind of like a younger rep version of Malcolm McDowell. And I mean that in a good way. He's just got that nice little cold steadiness there. Pat's doing a beautiful job here, isn't he, with wheel acting.
And of course...
and looking like he's only just a quarter rolling it in. And knowing exactly the right pitch to take.
Yeah, you mentioned Malcolm.
So much going on. He says, I'll just be the passive centre to this.
Now, diegetically, Linda has just put a wig on top of her other
diegetic wig. How many rugs are we doing right now? Is she on the wheel right now? You wouldn't know. My goodness, if you were in the bath, that would
be Anthony Ainley.
Spill your rubber duck, wouldn't it, Connor? Yes, there we go. Tyre's screeching. We haven't said hello to Maynard yet this episode.
No,
thank you, DJ Maynard.
Crab.
And all those wonderful times at Mad Club in our youth. I hope he's enjoying this. What would be the perfect soundtrack to this episode if you could choose anything? I think bongos.
Just bongos.
Just bongos.
And the crackle of Easter Sunday morning.
Yes, indeed.
As you get all those. That's a lot of Easter eggs they've gone through to cover these walls. But what I was going to say about Terry, sorry to get sidetracked, and really this takes the piss out of British schools so well.
Really, though.
It's a huge nod to P.G. Wodehouse and the fascism of P.G. Wodehouse. You know, in that with Roderick Spode, if you recall, who was the brown shorts leader of the real piss take on Mosley, and really nicely done. Oh, Pat, you're so good at doing so little so beautifully. You know, but look at the set. He's not going to compete with it. He's just going to sidle in on the sprocket holes and do what he does. But I wanted, if you want to bear with me. Do you have anything to add about this set at the moment or anything that's happening around? Oh, hello. Linda's come out in a bit of AstroTurf.
Yes. The only thing I have to say about this set is I absolutely adore it. I adore Tara's flat.
3 years before Mary Tyler Moore's.
Yes. And it's so wild and the mix of colours is so hideous. and yet, and
it's for color.
It's for color. It's, if I may say, more stylish than anything Batman was doing for color.
It's a good point, actually. We either of you boys ever witnessed to, so to say, burdened with seeing American TV on an American TV set in the 70s or early 80s? Were you ever over there or had friends who were like,
not in the NTSC days, no.
Yeah, so I have seen colour on an NTSC thing back in those days, and it is lurid.
Yes.
It is, really, I don't know why the entire nation doesn't have some kind of epileptic, you know, continuation. Actually, it's voting season soon, isn't it? So, but no, there's the whole migraine-inducing saturation of the NTSC, so you really got a gobful of it. It's poor Pat saying, ugh. Down on my knees again for Brian Clemens. This was voted by, what she's wearing right now is a kind of version you would sort of think of what they might have put Errol Flynn in 1938 when he was going to play Robin Hood, but wasn't sure if they were going to, he was going to play camp or not. What do you think of it?
Stephen?
Yeah.
Gosh.
So it's a sort of tan vest and waders and there was some spore and all the rest of it.
Like Tara King's apartment, like even the car, and also something that bothers me so much but shouldn't to that extent, Steed's sideburns. It's kind of an indicator of how the 60s sort of are moving out into the 70s at this point. And we're kind of leaving behind that, you know, golden-hued memory of, you know, the peak Avengers series, which are probably, you know, the black and white Emma Peel and the first and the one and only Emma Peel colour series as well. It looks different, doesn't it? Like the aesthetic, the design has sort of moved into the early 70s almost, I feel, rather than that 60s Britain that we were talking about and that corporate Britannia and all of its iconography and imagery, perhaps. That's how I feel. Certainly that's how I felt the first time I saw these episodes. It's like, oh, it kind of feels like, I don't want to say jump to shark because I know Brendan loves this period so much, but it feels like we've moved past that period that I'm so in love with.
No, I'm definitely with you that there's something visually distinct, and sometimes I feel wrong compared to what has come before. Now, in terms of this particular outfit for Linda, I quite like it.
Oh, okay.
But she will have better outfits. Like, I like it in a sort of way of I'm watching it going, how dare you put that on television? but also, okay, I'm coming along with you.
The hair, the puffy sleeves, the waist, the bottom, the
it's a bit brassiere.
I mean, everything's competing to be the biggest thing in the room, isn't it?
It's the Billy Piper's face of Avengers.
Don't you dare say that about my Billy.
But listen, Harvey Gould was told to design for her bosom and hips and her thrusting femininity. They were the nose.
None of that's there.
Really? Yeah. but then Linda also said, well, look, the way they were playing it and the evident age difference, and certainly the British critics had a go at this between herself and Steed. She said, I have to be in love with him. I mean, it's just so natural that a young girl would look up to a man like this and, you know, project her own, you know, relationships of her past with her father and all the rest of it. Linda's a very clever girl, always was. But she said she wanted a decidedly sexual relationship between hers and Steed's characters. And in the same interview in 69, the interviewer also said, or quoted her as favouring topless bathing, not wearing brassieres, and seeing her role as using sex appeal rather than force to get what she wanted from men. So I think, really, we can see how we were all primed to receive this, all 38 inches of her, other than her 5'9". Well, what do they mean by thrusting?
I do not know.
Although there is the bottom.
It's
very impressive.
You know, it's the whole thing of... It's the whole thing of men, you know, this reads like a man writing for a woman. Like, she's tittering boobily down the stairs.
You and I do it quite
often.
Yes,
that's true. I'm doing it now.
But you say that, but the execution is sort of buttons and pantomime, really, isn't it? Like, it's far from flattering to the feminine form. It's a bit androgynous almost, which is, again, presaging perhaps an early 70s vibe in terms of the glam rock, which obviously hasn't come yet, but maybe is hinting towards it, Richard? I'm not sure.
I like what you're saying, because this has a naivety and innocence which harkens back to Barbarella. Although, of course, that wasn't actually released when this was filmed. But her naive, you know, kittenish charm, innocence, you know, amongst all the guile, is
absolutely spot on
to Vardam's and Terry Southern's brilliant writing. I think he was a great comic writer anyway. But now we have the piss taken for Cybermen. I also like that he's dressed up as a kind of Easter egg billiard ball moomin.
Mm.
And how good is Linda in this when she's got, you know, there's... Oh, by the way, Linda, we can up Sean Connery and Dr. No. And that is bloody terrifying. I don't care what anybody says that it's not terrifying. It's terrifying. Mm. And lovely, lovely shots and close-ups. And is this Don Sharp, the director? Because he's really good.
It is Don Sharp, the director. Yes, you're right.
Yeah, he has a good background.
It's his debut, I think.
Mm. Yes, I think it would be.
I thought he did some rigs. Okay, that's interesting because he, as an action director, he's really already really well respected in the industry. And that's just great. Who else is not going, ugh? I don't know for how you two feel. I didn't grow up with Linda. I only came to her in the 90s, but I think she's doing this brilliantly. There's really no other way you can get all of those lists of requirements and have to deal with something that even Barbara Shelley would say, oh, that's a bit much, dear, for, you know, as a set. I really don't know how else the actors are going to work through it. But there's a lot of P.G. Woodhouse in the way these scenes are being played out. Can I read you a line from his take on fascism in 1935?
Ooh.
Is that good timing? Yes. It's from Blanding's Castle, which is one of... I mean, they're all good, but that's one of his best. And he said, they say Great Britain is still a first-class power, doing well and winning respect from the nations. And if so, it is, of course, extremely gratifying. But what of the future? This is what Lord Emsworth was asking himself. Could this happy state of things last? He thought not. Now, they were saying this in the 30s, and of course by the 60s, with the, you know, the antagonism of the end of empire and the nervousness that they're all going through, realizing that they don't actually have an economy anymore when they don't have, you know, when they don't have serfs paying respect. Oh, here we go. It's a nice little moment from I was going to say from 2001, but of course that hasn't come out yet.
No.
It's a bit Ark in Space.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh, so, here we go. Rock's falling. Terry trope.
if we want to get socially. Oh wow! Look at that.
Mm.
No Louise Jamison to toss her. Oh, hello.
Snake's back, and very very wisely cut away.
In skins in. Yes. Oh, by the way, if you were looking for the tunnel, here's the tunnel.
helpfully marked.
So good. So we have a set of what looks like a regional lower grade British public school that also has a fascistic intent and diabolical Adam West cave underneath it. This cave is also seen, of course, in The Saint, in The Persuaders, as a wine cellar, of course, because Tony and Roger are in it, and The Champions, and probably everything else we've ever seen. And there's a lovely map of Scarro for the kids at home. Can you see that? That Terry's coloured in himself. Can you see the sea of glass and the puddle of acid? And a
ventilator shaft for a handy
the
escape.
A ventilator shaft of sudden death. Yes, it's all there.
But this is what I mean when I say Terry tropes. Like, it's such boy's own adventure. And, you know, the map of the tunnel just Handley being there. And, you know, it's all... I just think it's... It's old even by this stage, but there's also something a bit comforting about it.
You got it.
I don't think this is a great script. You know, we talked about Don Sharp. His direction, actually, I don't think it's that bad. And in some instances, it's quite good, like that example that you were talking about before, Richard, where Linda's really giving it all. And, you know, her performance, might have something to say about that later on. You know, really fantastic. I just think the script here is what really lets it down. And then second to that, perhaps the production values as well. It does look a bit cheap and nasty in terms of the studio, which is so at odds with what the rest of the Avengers has looked like.
I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. This cost £230,000.
Oh my God.
No, it didn't actually. It cost a lot more. The allocated budget was £230,000, but with the reshoot and remountings, it cost a hell of a lot more.
Gosh.
I think Terry is known for only delivering concepts, if we can be generous, doesn't
yes.
he? So there were broad things, there were all of this stuff. He's definitely noting, you know, Woodhouse-style fascism. You just said it, Stephen, the joy of this and what the Americans picked up on, and certainly the Australians, is the gentle, indolent bonhomie of, oh, our empire's dying, we're all going to be horribly poor, but it's still actually a bit of a laugh, isn't it? And there's that style of, rather than panicking, we'll just go down gracefully, although we've got a spear in our elbow. And Linda's kind of, I don't know, Linda feels like the energetic opposite of that, whereas Pat is showing the insouciance of, you know, sharing a brandy with Roger Delgado before they both get squished by whatever's Roger's brought down this everything. If it were an episode of Doctor Who, there's that sense of, oh yes, it's all ending, but you know, we'll go down stiffly but smiling, 38 inches of us, and then there's poor Linda. But Linda represents youth, folly, exuberance, newness, and I think she actually is showing, she's meant to represent the American audience in this.
That's really interesting.
And just how they're being done over. Right. Oh, hello.
It makes a lot of sense because, you know, both Honora Blackman and Diana Rigg are both played it so cool and calm and collected and sophisticated. It's such a different performance from Linda Thorson. It's not to say it's worse. It's probably actually more actorly in some regards. You know, there are those accusations that, you know, perhaps there's a retirement from acting for a year or two there by the previous ladies. But Linda's really giving it a roll, I think. Yeah. And I can't fault her for that. But I do wonder, does that fit in with what the Avengers has become after five series, perhaps?
I think early Tara certainly is a step backwards.
You feel that in this one?
But I do feel it in this one, but I don't. It's not Linda's fault. It's that whole thing of being given totally contradictory notes because they've come from a committee of people not in the country of production, but who are providing the money.
There was a critic at the time who described her swinging of a handbag rather than fighting with a side of her hand made her a far more probable woman. And I really can't say it in any other voice. You are a very probable woman, probably.
But
here we go. I was just going to add to that and tell me what you think. I don't think she could have played this episode as had Honor or Diana. You can't. If she was cool with everybody else being cool, we'd be looking at a very flat and flaccid 50 minutes.
There's
no energetic center other than Linda. Mm.
Oh, that's the thing.
And Janet standing.
Yeah, I think at all times Linda is giving 100% throughout the season, and is let down by inconsistent production decisions. And Pat, I think, also is giving it all of his energy, but sometimes during the season is a bit lost at sea because the show has changed so much, the culture has changed so much, and, you know, something I find sort of interesting about the villains in this is they are so still and they're not the sort of diabolical masterminds we've come to know and love. They're like
they're Ronioed cookie cutter British fascist posh boys.
Yes. but you know, it's kind of weird. They're a more credible threat, which in the Avengers makes them a less credible threat because, you know, they're playing with their mobiles, as we see here. But
did you have baubles like that as boys? Do you remember the rayon fiber baubles that if the cat got anywhere near it were destroyed within milliseconds? So they were actually threads. It was a fabric thread that was stretched over them.
Yep.
I remember the frustration of trying to make things out of those as a child, and they would disintegrate as soon as you touched them. There's something for boys of a certain age at home.
Yeah. But, you know, William Lucas here is playing it absolutely...
Camp.
It's weird.
Straight camp.
Yes. Yes.
Or in just military.
Yeah, not arch camp, but I totally believe in this character.
Yes, he has sufficient flying buttresses for this one. I think Linda's fine. She's actually the Barbara Bain of this episode, right now, anyway. And astonishingly pretty. I can see the likeness to McLean, but I actually think she's more like Jean Tierney, if you remember her. You know Laura Stephen, that gorgeous film noir with Jean Tierney?
I don't think I've seen that.
1941 or 42. Okay, we're watching that. We'll share that one. It's just a gorgeous film. And a murder and mystery about a girl who disappeared and was considered murdered and then just appears again and comes back. It's a great film. And there's nods to, you know, all of those film noirs in this series of The Avengers. There's nods to a lot. I think this is post-postmodern by now, isn't it? Because it's sourcing and ridiculing itself. Or you might say Avengers has been doing that since Honor Blackman's time. But so we've just got a lot of yellow skivvies. And Pat having a bit of fun, reminding himself of his glory days at the Eton playing fields, or at least on the sidelines. He's tying up a blonde boy. trussing him up for Lent. and you know what? Not too many complaints from Turlough.
No. Yeah. With what you were saying about the direction earlier, Stephen, I feel like every shot is interesting and purposeful. Like, so Williams just opened that door and all the students beyond are perfectly framed by the door. Mm-hmm. And earlier on when Linda fainted, he appears between the two students. You know, the directing is very purposeful. So I think I agree with you, Stephen, in that the thing that is really letting this down is that Terry has perhaps never seen the show before. Terry Nation.
No, he did not write any Avengers scripts before this.
No,
he
didn't.
I'm correct. Yeah, but he'd done it.
But we
feel this is so familiar.
Yes, yeah. Well, that's the thing. I think Terry's gone, I don't actually know what this is about. I'm just going to do my usual thing. Because this does feel very much like it's written for, say, 12-year-olds.
I was going to say 25 minutes.
Yeah. Both are true. Or... cynically, American audiences. And let's not forget just how snooty British writers, British thinking was about American audiences, especially in the 60s. And that's not actually even their fault. That came from the US. You know, it was Howard Thomas, the big money guy at AB Associated British, who told Pat that he's being far too emasculated. Diana's doing all the work for you. You only come in... You know, he was talking about Superlative 7, and he said, if it wasn't for Donald Sutherland and Charlotte Rampling, you'd have had nothing to do. And he said, oh, hang on, that's not how it was written. He said, anyway, I'm firing the telly men, being, of course, Brian Clemens, Albert Fennell, and Julian Wintle, and bringing in Johnny Byrne again. Pat just said, what? He said, thunderstruck. He said, keep saying Johnny Byrne. We've got Johnny Bryce coming in. He's taking over the show. He'll breathe new life into the show and you and inject reality into the plots. And Pat just said, you know, Pat actually at the time, well, at least it says in the 90s, you know, he said, television has moved on. We can't do straight, you know, Dashiell Hammett, Fleming pastiche things with a wry wit and on video. It's this film now. It's a completely different way of working. So, and he was proven right, of course. But that's why you've got Linda behaving like this. So Pat is, she's, you know, meant to appear vulnerable, that acting on the moment and on instinct and a fresh recruit, but also, there you go, goodness me, all those thighs at once. The static electricity is overcoming in those nylon jumpsuits. But also that they wanted the roles reversed. And Pat said, no, I play the woman. She's supposed to play the man.
That's right.
I love Pat.
that's always what's made the Avengers so wonderful, though. So just upset that and you know, reestablish, I guess, you know, the gender norms or expected gender norms. I don't know. Again, maybe just another example of the way in which the show seems you know, Brendan, you used the word wrong. I don't know if I would call it that, but I know what you mean. That it's kind of something else now. And maybe that's just by virtue of the fact that we are no longer in a period that I sort of said 1965 to 68, which is real, that sort of height of Cool Britannia. We've passed that now. And maybe this is just reflecting a society or, you know, expectations, particularly from American side, that just doesn't exist anymore, if it ever did exist, as I said last week. Yeah, it's just not the Avengers that I perhaps gravitate towards and appreciate most as a result. Mm. And here's the Cyberman looking absolutely... How can the BBC make a more more convincing astronaut / cyber figure than that? That's terrible, honestly.
Yeah, sure, I'd like to know what's in the script notes, but I'm sure Terry was having his go.
A blank featureless helmet.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Well, Ray Cusick once said to Terry Nation, "You're always right. They walk into a blank, featureless room. Why is that?" You can come up with it, darling.
Pat did say that, you know, when he was with Honor, John Bryce was working with Richard Bates, you know, on the Blackman shows, and Pat said Bryce was deeply sweet, utterly supportive, and an absolutely excellent on-point producer. But he said, now, I'm sorry, but he was a complete and utter disaster. And the rumours on the set said that it was Johnny Bryce who was saying to ABPC, the Americans' money, that Clemens had denuded and emasculated the programme and wheedled his way in. Now, that's only a rumour. Pat couldn't say where he heard that from. But, you know... it's production stuff, isn't it? So I hope that Johnny wasn't behaving like that. But anyway, Pat just says, like, the whole thing were just hopeless. John didn't even check if... excuse me. Johnny hadn't even checked if vehicles were hired or, you know, things were organised. Wow. So that's why you don't see the Bentley, because he hadn't booked it for this episode. That's why you've actually got Tara's car instead all through it. They lost about half a day's shooting because of that. By the fourth day of shooting, they had little more than a couple of minutes of usable film.
Oh, my God.
And Bryce was forced to call in the second unit to work alongside the main team. So, I mean, the whole team was rumbling at this point, and that he just didn't have film experience. I think we've all had nerves and all the rest of it, but apparently, whenever Pat suggested something, both on this and the first one they shot, this is the second shoot they did together, Johnny would roar, "No, that won't work, Pat. Do it my way. I'm in charge," which, you know, didn't go down well. But Don Sharp was brought in because of the problems on their first episode shoot to direct the one we're watching now. And Don Sharp also remembers and discusses this episode when he says, "While shooting The Champions at ATC Elstree, I ran into Gordon Scott, who asked if I would be interested in directing a new series of The Avengers, which was in the pipeline. And Don says, I'd seen and admired quite a lot of the earlier series and had also been friendly with Albert Fennell in my days with Independent Artists at Beaconsfield. And he was amazed when Gordon told him that Albert and Brian were no longer involved at all. But it was given a whole fresh new look. Anyway, within a week," Don Sharp goes on, "Howard Thomas and John Bryce had said yes to me joining the team. I joined in October. Howard and I had worked together for many years on the Pathé documentary unit. You know, they were all ex-wartime boys. But he said, you know, they were all meant to be whiz kids. Gordon Scott said Johnny Bryce was a whiz kid. Thomas was full of praise also for Bryce and expected great things. The Americans were hurling an enormous amount of money. These cost much more than the rigs. Of course, you've got to take in inflation. And now we're looking down a Dalek eye shaft." God, Linda's good in this. But anyway, he just goes on to say that it was this was a well-constructed action-adventure piece with actually a solid setting. So I didn't pick that up watching this. I don't think any of us did. But you know, the director says that this was actually nicely laid out as a script when they got it. But it just didn't have the personality of the Avengers. Mm. Now, that's the director saying that. Mm. He said, if this was to be the start of a new partnership, then some serious thinking was needed. He said, you know, Pat and I had been a team, and that's just me watching the show with my kids at home, two experienced actors of equal stature with strong individual personalities. Linda was told to play it as, you know, as a far less experienced girl. And he said, you know, that's not what the show was meant to be about. So how do you then get that to work? And I'll stop right there because I'm interested in what you think about that, and also what Linda's doing right now, which is really showing Liz Sladen how to crawl through a tube, isn't it?
Okay, what's going to come through? What's going to come through and drop on her head? It's spiders.
So, yeah, well, all we can take from that, and this is Don Sharp saying this, he says, look, to be blunt, Johnny Bryce seemed more concerned with finding the absolute opposite to everything Dyrig had ever done than with matters of character and relationship. It was all just about extremes rather than subtleties. And he said it was very difficult to pin him down on discussions for any aspect on how to direct Linda. He just left this to me and to her and to Pat. So all the character development, this is interesting, isn't it? All the character development you're seeing is them working it out on the day.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, look,
you
go on, Stephen.
No, I was just going to say, and that might work if there's a script behind it, but as I say, this script is probably written not just for 12-year-olds, as you say, Brendan, but for 25 minutes, because this third act is basically the two protagonists meet, you know, walking towards one another in a tunnel. That's... That's not exactly high stakes, and that might work for episode 3 or 4 of Genesis of the Daleks as a bit of padding, but it really shows up here in, you know, 50-odd minute episode where you're trying to, you know, get action adventure as a genre and all of this sort of stuff. It just doesn't work for me, I don't think.
No, that's a really excellent point, I think.
Yeah.
I actually found myself, you know, watching Linda crawling through that tunnel thinking, We start off this episode, and even when William Lucas explains the plot to Tara, it, you know, it's saying something about colonization and empire and what have you. And, you know, Steed and Tara are actually fighting against even the concept of aggressively going out to colonize other planets.
Well, there's a bit of post-colonialism. Mm.
But because it's just surrounded by such thinness... I think any sort of merit that plot has kind of gets lost because we devote 2 or 3 times the amount to Steed has just jumped over an acid pool because they're on they're on Marinus now.
They really are.
But you know, God bless Linda a few scenes ago with some toy spiders being thrown at her with music accompanying from the fear merchants. You know, her acting sells that moment.
Yeah, it has to.
You know, certainly not the spiders. And I should just mention the young man who was just speaking in that group of goons is a very young Warren Clark before he became much more famous with
Detective Inspector Deal.
That's
yes.
Right.
So it is. Oh, my goodness. Well, some of us liked a Porky Pie or two, didn't we? Linda, that's no aspersions on your leather knickers acting right there. God, I love Linda. Is this time to say Hugh Crutwell, who was head of RADA, said to Pat the week they were filming this? Because Pat was really saying to the boys, you need to find somebody else. So I hadn't read that before either. And Hugh Crutwell, who was the head of RADA, said to Pat, you're getting our top student, Pat. She is the very best we had. And John Houston agrees with me. So, and she was, Linda has said, she had independent, you know, verification from John Houston. Whatever relationship she did or did not have with Johnny Bryce at the time, which, you know, everyone else has talked about, you still don't make it without those big names behind you.
Hmm. Well, Linda in recent years has openly discussed that, yes, she was dating John Bryce, the producer, before he started working on the show again. But... even in that case, she had to audition like everyone else. And also, she was brought in during the audition process because they weren't finding what they liked with other women they were auditioning. So, yeah. You know, it was... it has been alleged in the past that the other women were auditioned as a smokescreen to cast the producer's girlfriend, when in fact John suggested that she audition well into the audition process. But it may be of interest to know that some other names who were considered were Susan Engel, better known as Vivian
Cesaire of Diplos.
Cesaire of Diplos.
It's weird watching her.
That's strange.
But, you know, it was finally down to Mary Peach and Jane Merrow.
Yes.
So we know Jane Merrow from the Anderson series.
Yes.
And she's in UFO.
And also from Mission Highly Improbable.
And she's also in a $6 Million Man episode. Mm. Venus Probe. She does not play Venus in that one, just in case you're curious. But I've got to say, and you've touched on this last week, Brent, or last month, Brendan, that it's actually Ray Austin who pretty much saved the series and saved this show, at least for these two. Because according to Pat, he said Ray took him aside when... Which episode, and I'm sorry to throw this at you, was Ray first on for this season?
Oh, I couldn't tell you off the top of my head. But I think it is in that first batch of seven that they hurriedly make.
Well, we'll look that up while I'll just share with you Pat's recollection. Pat McNee in his notes says, Ray Austin laid it on the line to me one day between, you know, the shoot. It wasn't going well. I wasn't working well with Linda. And I honestly didn't have a lot of confidence in the lady as a performer. Love her very much as a person. And of course, we know that. But Ray said, Pat, I know you think Linda's not the right one for us, but they like her, they being the ABC network executives in Britain and the US. And they want to keep her in, and I want to keep her in. And you have a great chemistry together. Just trust yourself and trust me. And, give her a chance. Take her under your wing, which are his exact words. And Pat said, you know, he just relaxed. And he said, everyone else on the team did seem to get along well with Linda. Was I missing something? Pat said. And John Bryce, meanwhile, was sending the show down the tubes, according to everyone else. He said he was ranting, raving, continued to dismiss every suggestion made by the performers. Pat felt the show was crumbling. Linda appeared to be full of enthusiasm, but of course, Pat knew later on that she was finding it very difficult. Can you imagine being in a relationship with someone who's in charge and nobody else is supporting on the set? I don't think I'd want to work in that situation either. Anyway, Pat said I just used to go home and drink a lot. That's how he managed with it. And then again, 6 weeks later, Bryce was fired and Brian and Albert mysteriously were in the office the next morning. So,
and speaking of 6 weeks later, here's approximately 6 months later.
It is that long time, and she looks a very different woman, doesn't she?
Yes, yes.
They've got her in a cagoule, so you don't notice that the airbags are no longer employed. In the AC.
Please stop.
We're just talking about crap. But I think that's why they've got her in such a baggy suit to show that she's lost some, she has lost so much weight.
Yeah. Ray Austin directed Invitation to a Killing, which became Have Guns, Will Haggle, written as Tara's introductory story, which is why I do now remember Linda talking about why Ray Austin was such a friend and defender for her. And when she wanted to leave after making about six or seven episodes, by that point, Patrick McNee said to her, no, don't leave. We are going to make this work together.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
And on the topic of Terry Nation, I would like to point out he goes on to write Takeover.
Oh, yes.
Which is one of the best episodes of this era. And is deeply psychological and very tense. Everything about this episode is just tension, isn't it? It's tension between two extremes.
With a really odd, quiet centre. And that quiet centre is British fascism. It's just left completely denuded and incapable and shown to be a little bit of a joke and a bit boyzone and a bit amateurish in the ways that the Avengers are also amateurs, but successful ones.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Well, I do find it very interesting that, you know, it's Tara who lands the killing blow against their general.
Their general what?
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
she threw him through the door at the end, not Steed. So, you know, it there's nascent qualities of what the strengths of this era would be. But look, I don't think this is the worst of the three Bryce episodes.
But I actually don't mind any of them, but they're so recut, it's hard to say, yeah, isn't it?
But it's also, this is probably the best of the three Bryce episodes.
Yeah, that is also true.
Yeah.
But, you know, Don Sharp also said that things changed for the better immediately. He said it was literally a 24-hour change.
Mm.
And I think it's just that everyone was used to working with the boys. And also that poor Johnny Bryce, you know, if you're nervous and you're the head of school, that's just going to filter down.
Yes. So, yes, exactly.
You know, it's also hard when you're thrown into completely recreate something on your own. I don't believe that he had any other support other than, you know, just being told do what you want.
But, you know, if he's been backgrounding the existing producers and saying they're not doing a good job, he's really got no one to blame but himself.
That's the current term, isn't it? The lampshading thing. Mm. Well, look, Pat said it happened, so, you know. Mm. Got dark there suddenly, didn't it? What do we think, boys? What do you think of Linda in that one, then, to sum up?
It's so difficult to say because it's so atypical of, I guess, what the rest of Series 6 is like in so many regards. We'll see different, more Linda episodes as we go on with the podcast. But I think this is really early on in her reign, I guess, and that shows. The chemistry isn't quite right there with Pat, as you say. That shows. I think John Bryce probably doesn't have the same vision that we'll eventually sort of see play out with the rest of the series as well. So it's really difficult to make any kind of, you know, summative judgment or, you know, form an opinion that's really valid about Tara King's character and Linda Thorson's performance on the basis of this one alone, I think. So yeah, it's really, really an odd one, this one. And I can kind of understand why it's not very well thought of.
Does it land, so to speak? I don't think it does.
It crashes?
Yeah. And I don't really know what it's trying... Exactly. I don't really know what it's trying to do. And honestly, I get the sense that there's only one person pulling to make it, to bring it to centre, and that's Linda.
Hmm.
And it's not just on her back and falling over and doing all of those things, which must have been incredibly painful. But I feel she's actually carrying the energy for the entire episode.
Hmm.
She's kind of like the Deborah Watling, I guess, in this particular episode, where, you know, but you can see that she's a great actress and has got so much, ability, but it's just misapplied and misdirected, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Right. So that was Invasion of the Earthmen, and we.
I want to run out and buy a pair of leather trousers and a jerkin. That's the rest of you.
Why is you don't have
and maybe already? And maybe a Simon Le Bon pirate shirt as well. Just, you know.
Oh.
What was interesting about that is when she took the jerkin off, the silhouette is not dissimilar to one of her best outfits that she ends up wearing in All Done with Mirrors.
That's so good.
Yes. Yeah. But we promise that next time we pick a Tara King episode, it'll be a good one. It's an interesting one. And you know what? I think it's a good episode to talk about the production chaos that was going on.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, yeah. You know, anyone who's like, there's chaos in Cardiff. It's like, go watch Invasion of the Earth. Now, next month, we are going to be finishing off our theme of Reach for the Stars with Richard.
Oh, with a lovely Dan Dare shoot in our gorgeous stratospheric rocket to enjoy Honor Blackman once again in White Dwarf. The White Dwarf. We've explored Miss Blackman's performances on Bondfinger in the past, mm-hmm. in both The Saint and Danger Man. And the Avengers, but this will be our first go at speaking just about the Avengers with a bit of Doctor Who thrown in because it's us. And it's just a lovely episode. And of course, it's written by...
Well, it's Malcolm Hulk, the wonderful, great Malcolm Hulk.
It's fantastic. And Stephen, you mentioned something about the script or the history of the story I didn't even know. So I'm really looking forward to hearing about that next month.
Mm.
It's just a lovely... Yeah, it's a lovely, dry, witty, anti-establishment take on the goings-on and just how absurd it all is, as Malcolm Hulk did so well. And Honor Blackman just shines with really with just the effort of one eyebrow and a perfectly penciled-in mole on her cheek. She can totally destroy a room full of ministers and fascists.
Yes. And I would like to also tease the listener with one other thing about the White Dwarf. We had a lot to say about Johnny Bryce this episode.
Yeah.
Well, for the White Dwarf, that was an episode early in his tenure as producer of the videotape era. So let's see how he went with a very different production schedule.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in that case, all that's left to say is, until next time, may all your spiders be immobile. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.
Be seeing you.
And don't let your baubles unravel.